We've been hearing so much in the last couple of days about the differences between the Irish approach to all of this and the British approach to all of this, the nature and timing of the approaches, whether they've prioritised health over the economy and business, and how exactly each country's health service is set to be able to deal with what's coming down the line. And one man, of course, who knows an awful lot about the capacity of both health services is Gabriel Scally, who's a former regional director of public health in England. Of course, he was the head of the most recent inquiry into cervical check, and he joined us on the line. Gabriel Scally, good morning to you, and thanks very much for taking our call this morning. As a general overview,
good morning.
How do you believe the Irish Health Service is set to deal with everything that's coming down the tracks?
Well, I think the strategic direction that the government has taken is absolutely right. There can be no half measures with this virus. So the twin track approach of rigorous testing, mass testing, and contact tracing and isolating the virus that way, and really getting ahead of the virus and damping it down completely, is absolutely the right way. It's been successful in South Korea. It's been successful in China. That's great. And if that's done successfully, then the health service...
Oh, it sounds like we've just lost the connection of Gabriel Scally. We'll try to get him back in just a meantime. There are a couple of texts and tweets already coming in, by the way. Do keep them coming. 53106 is the number for your text. Let me go in the meantime while we're trying to get Gabriel Scally back. Let's go to Dr. Siobhan Kennelly, who is the HSC National Clinical Lead for Older Persons. Dr. Kennelly, good morning to you and a happy Mother's Day to you. In your particular brief as the Clinical Lead for Older Persons, you will be responsible for the whole process of cocooning, which is something that we heard Leo Varadkar talk about in his address to the nation on Tuesday evening. Can you give us an overview of exactly what cocooning would entail?
Well, thanks, Gavin. So basically, cocooning is really referring to those extra measures that we're asking people in more vulnerable groups to take in order to really minimise any possible exposure to coronavirus. So essentially, we're really referring to groups of people who fall into older age, particularly 60 years, and those over 75 are particularly vulnerable. People who have a long-term medical condition such as heart disease, lung disease, cancer or high blood pressure, or those indeed who have a weakened immune system, which might be the result of cancer treatment or treatment that they're on that's suppressing their immune system for another reason, such as with rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease.
And does all of that effectively mean then that those people are going to be have their lives organised so that they don't come into any direct human contact with anyone else at all, or will there still be even some minimal amount of interactions?
So I think it's actually very important that we try and balance the messages around this here as much as possible. We're very aware of the potential for negative impact of any, you know, adverse kind of social isolation in this particular type of environment over a prolonged time. And I suppose that speaks to the reason why we're asking all of the public to take all of the measures that we're asking so seriously, because obviously the less time that any group, and particularly more vulnerable groups, have to spend in a more protected environment, the better it will be actually for them and for everybody else. Mm. So, I mean, they are being asked, and the measures that are being asked to take are on the website hse.ie. But it is very important, I suppose. They are the group who are most at risk of severe disease if they contract coronavirus. And the impact, I suppose, for them has much more significant consequences than might be the case in other groups. And that is why those specific measures are being advised for that group at that time.
Sure.
But it is also important to say that those people within those groups, for example, who are in receipt of home care, that home care provision will continue. And we would ask people to continue to allow, for example, their home care and supports to actually continue to access them.
So the likes of home help or people who come around
home,
to older vulnerable people, that will still continue?
Exactly. That will still continue. And indeed, some of that will actually be ramped up in the days and weeks ahead. Because we are aware of the vulnerabilities posed to people in those circumstances, with these conditions.
Okay.
We're also, sorry, go ahead.
No, I don't want to be too sort of alarmist, but obviously given the circumstances and given that individual people who work in the home help scheme will be engaging with multiple older people or vulnerable people at any one time, are we likely to see those home help people having to go around to those people wearing a particular amount of PPE themselves, where they might have to wear more masks, or they might even, and I only say this because I want people to be prepared, the idea that they might have to wear full protective suits while they're engaging with older people?
So those issues will only arise where people have symptoms or they have been close contacts of other people with coronavirus. So, and specific guidance has been actually issued to the home health services themselves so that they will know what circumstances themselves they will actually need to wear personal protective equipment in. For everybody else and home health in general, it will be about advice to the current, you know, adherence to the current advice around hand hygiene, which they are already kind of, you know, very well versed in. It will be around advice around appropriate social distancing insofar as they can manage that. A lot of these home healths are delivering direct care in some instances, and in some instances they will actually need to wear personal protective equipment as part of delivering that direct care. In many instances that actually happens already. And then, important then that if home healths themselves have symptoms that they that may potentially point to coronavirus, that they may be required to self-isolate. But they've actually been given advice, and their managers have been given advice around that, and they'll know what to do in those circumstances.
And without meaning to talk about any individual instances, people who heard me read the front pages of the papers just a few minutes ago will know that there is at least one instance of 14 people, residents at a nursing home, who are believed to have contracted COVID-19 and may perhaps have all done so through interactions with a particular worker or a healthcare worker or a member of staff at that facility. Are there likely to be any extra precautions that the likes of private nursing homes are going to need to take to mitigate against the probability of that happening in their own cases?
Yes, as of yesterday, all non-essential visiting has stopped and has been advised to cease in all our nursing homes and institutions. I want to actually, Gavin, though, thank firstly and pay tribute to the staff in all of these services who are caring for a very, very vulnerable group of residents and who are actually facing enormous challenges and pressures at this time in sometimes very challenging environments, as you might imagine. These can be environments where, you know, staff are working on, you know, extended shifts to cover sure. Other staff who may be self-isolating. And just like the rest of us, they're trying to provide as much care as they can within those care settings.
But is there a particular message for nursing homes or what they might need to do?
Well, I think, in fairness, you know, we've had very close engagement with Nursing Homes Ireland and a number of the other bodies that are managing care in those settings. Most of them, if not all, have very good preparedness plans, and there's ongoing engagement around how they are going to be supported in terms of personal protective equipment and other issues that are arising for them.
Before I let you go, just on the topic of Mother's Day and the temptation that people might have, or they might think that it's okay to, even if it's just a very brief visit, just to go and give them a cuddle and say that they're thinking of them. The advice to those people who might be contemplating just even a brief visit like that?
We are really asking today, because of the circumstances that pertain for us nationally, that people do not visit each other today within those, and particularly within those high-risk groups. But I think the message really needs to go out that this is around how we all help each other and, maximise our opportunity for social distancing. I can see the lovely fine spring day that's out there. I know exactly what people are thinking, you know, but actually today is not the day to actually visit your mum. There will be many other Mother's Days, please God, that we will have the opportunities in which to do so if we take the correct action today.
Okay. Dr. Siobhan Kennelly, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Siobhan Kelly is the HSE National Clinical Lead for Older Persons and has been joining us this morning on The Record. backward. We have Gabriel Scally back on the line, a former regional director of public health in England. Gabriel, I suppose it's a sign of the times that we live in, that telecoms, communications and infrastructure, they're all under a little bit more pressure than they used to be. But glad to have you back on the line. As someone who knows the two health services quite well, do you think that the Republic's approach, which you were lauding a few moments ago, is in any way undermined by the UK and Northern Ireland in particular being slightly later to impose the same restrictions on people?
Well, it's not just the restrictions. I think the UK approach is disastrous, absolutely disastrous. They're completely out of line with World Health Organization advice. They stopped testing in the community, right? In each of the four countries of the UK, well over a week ago, stopped completely. So there's no testing going on. They don't know where the cases are. They only know when people arrive in hospital. And they are flying blind. And you can't fight this fire blindfolded. You cannot. So I am extraordinarily worried about the UK position. And the predictions for London in particular, which seems to be a hotbed of the virus, are really dire for a fortnight's time. So it's really important that Ireland sticks to particularly to the testing, contact tracing, isolation way of doing things. And I can't emphasize this enough. You cannot be too tough in terms of quarantine and isolation. I think there's a problem for the island as a whole. If the North continues to take the UK, the misguided and mistaken UK approach, and follows the wisdom from Westminster, because I think that wisdom is deeply flawed. And I think that is a problem, and it requires really, you know, great diplomatic skills between the Assembly government in the North and the government in the Republic to try and do the right thing for all the people of the island. This is an all-Ireland virus. It's not going to respect the borders, and it's a, you know, together standing tall moment.
You obviously know all about the whole question in principle of capacity in laboratories in the Irish health system to be able to test certain samples that have been taken from certain patients, albeit in slightly different circumstances. We've already heard lots of anecdotal reports this week of people who have been booked in for a test, the swab, to see whether they've contracted COVID-19, but they're being told they'll have to wait a couple of days, and then after that it'll be a couple of days before the results come back. Are you at all concerned about the extent of the waiting lists and the ability that it presents to the state to actually get on top of all of this?
Oh, well, I think everyone must be concerned about that. But this is, it's a really tough job to do what the Irish government's trying to do, which is get testing out there to the mass of the people. And they're doing, you know, I can't emphasize this enough. They're going in exactly the right direction. I wish them Godspeed in their efforts. And of course, there will be delays. And that's regrettable. Delays in getting the results, sometimes that's built into the type of test. It's a matter of ramping these things up. And I'm so impressed to see the testing facility being built in Offaly and the testing facility being built on the Keys by the Irish Defence Forces. That's deeply impressive.
It very much is. Gabriel Scally, we will let you go. Thanks again for having the patience, for letting us have a second try at getting the whole of you this morning. Dr. Gabriel Scally, former Regional Director of Public Health in England, who is also an Honorary Professor of Public Health at the University of Bristol. By the by, if anyone is around the Keys in Dublin today and they see the LE Samuel Beckett there and they wonder whether this is the reputed lockdown that your WhatsApp may have told you about, it is not the lockdown. Rather, the LE Samuel Beckett will be online, we think, from tomorrow as a testing centre so that people can go along there and get tested and have their swabs taken, and then to have it as a sampling centre for COVID-19 to try and get to the bottom of this. It is not for anything more ulterior than that. Let me go to Dr. Chris Luke, who has been an emergency physician for 35 years, who has been very vocal about all of this in recent times. You perhaps haven't heard as much from him in the last few days because, having been retired, he is one of the many who have answered the call to return to the front line. Dr. Luke, you're with us now. Good morning and thanks very much for taking our call. When exactly did you get back on the ward and how did you find it?
Good morning, Gavin. Yes, no, I went back on Friday after, as I say, a gap of about 18 months. And, first of all, I was delighted to see all the familiar faces and, of course, was immediately reminded of how absolutely wonderful our healthcare professionals are in every discipline, in every part of the hospital. I mean, obviously, I'm particularly focused on the emergency response in the emergency department, where there were enormous preparations going on in terms of kit, actually building, you know, segregating and putting up perspex and reconfiguring the flow of people through the department. and obviously an enormous amount of training going on. And I think everybody now in the healthcare system and in the public health response realize that the guidance is changing daily. So we're used to that, and that's because the science is unfolding daily from around the world. And one of the things that's emerged, obviously, is that the you know, global science is being shared. So that's one advantage we have over previous pandemics, is that, you know, there is a great deal of really good research going on all around the world that's being shared quickly.
How did you find the morale on your first shift back? How are spirits holding
super,
up?
I mean, absolutely super people, you know, very, very resolute. Very, very determined to do exactly the right thing. People brushing up on their, you know, infectious disease preparation, and a great solidarity between all the staff. I mean, from catering to management to clinicians and scientists. You know, a wonderful esprit de corps, I think that you'd call that in the army.
Well, I'm glad certainly to hear it, because obviously, as we know, there is more serious and acute crises to come, given on the projections of how this is likely to progress in the next week or so.
Yes, I expect there to be, the uptick is coming this week, I have no doubt, and we will need all that resolution and solidarity. But just if I could just chime in with what Professor Scally said a minute ago, I'm completely in agreement with him. I think the government and the policymakers are following exactly the right track. My greatest concern is people drinking and partying, because the only reason for a lockdown in this country is if people keep getting locked, in the old Irish expression. If people keep drinking, they will simply be unable to heed the guidance and to, you know, keep their social distance and do all the things that they need to do. So the only reason for a lockdown, I think, is people continuing to drink and party.
You might have seen the piece on the front page of the Business Post this morning about how doctors have raised fears of an equipment shortage, and we all know about how much of a demand there has been on masks and other personal protective equipment. In your couple of days back on the wards, are you at all concerned about that, or are you satisfied that there will be enough physical kit?
I'm very much aware of it, Gavin. I'm very much aware of what's swirling around the internet and the newspapers. I didn't see any shortage, you know, in terms of our the preparations in the hospital. Obviously, everybody's anxious a bit about the supply chain, but I'm hearing from Minister Harris that there are enormous supply, a huge cargo of supplies coming in from China. As Dr. Scally said, you know, I'm seeing, I live quite near to Parkyqueave, and Parkyqueave in Cork has been transformed like Croke Park into a testing centre. I mean, some of these things are astonishingly impressive. And many people will be too old to remember, but I remember the only time I saw what I thought was astonishing Germanic efficiency in Ireland was in 1979, when I went with my mother on the bus at 4 a.m. to Phoenix Park to see the Pope. It's that sort of all-Ireland response which we're seeing at the moment. You know, the entire state is acting together. And, I mean, it's very impressive, and I think it's incredibly reassuring. The only thing is, my only concern is people continuing to party.
Well, it's certainly very encouraging to hear you being so impressed by the degree to which everything has come together. By comparison, I know that you worked for a long time in the UK. Very briefly, but just before we let you go back to work again, what do you make of the NHS approach and the way in which it is set for the crisis that Britain is going to be seeing, which is probably going to be much graver than ours because of how late they've moved?
Yeah, I completely agree with Gabriel Scally. I'm to be absolutely honest, I'm a little petrified. I'm profoundly disappointed and anxious about the British approach. I always thought this idea of growing immunity, a bizarre and anti-scientific approach, and to me it smacks of people, policymakers who are detached from reality. So again, as I say, I think we're doing exactly the right thing on our island. But again, this is a global fight. So, you know, we need to support our neighbours. We need to be mutually very neighbourly and very supportive, as we need to be within the island itself here.
Well, fair play for scrubbing back up again and responding to the call, and Godspeed and everything that you do. And hopefully the efforts that you and all of your colleagues in emergency departments across the country will be making for the next short while do bear fruit. Thanks very much for speaking
to us
this morning.
I greatly appreciate that.
Dr. Chris Luke, emergency physician who has recently returned, parked his retirement for a little while just to make sure that the front line is as best prepared as it can be. Let's park the whole health discussion of all of this for a little while, though, and talk about the political handling of it all. We are joined on the line by Uachtaráin Sinn Féin, the president and leader of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald. Mary Lou, good morning to you and happy Mother's Day to you. We know that your own children were attending the school in the east of the country, which had to close down after one of its pupils was diagnosed as having COVID-19. That means that I think your kids will have been serving the 2 weeks of self-isolation and then immediately discovered that the schools weren't going to be open again afterwards. So you have a little bit of a head start in the rest of us about how this is affecting your family. How has the mood been like for them?
Well, yes, good morning, Gavin, and a very happy Mother's Day to all of the mothers out there listening. And certainly, I think for all of us, for every family now with younger children or with teenagers, it's a big challenge just to manage things and to ensure that there's still some routine, that schoolwork still gets done, and that you try and keep a bit of order and peace and harmony. So we're into week four in the Big Brother house now at this stage. And yeah, it's been testing. My son has tried to convince me that housework makes him more vulnerable to the virus. So those are the kinds of conversations that we're having. It's testing, it's trying. But look, I think we all have to just accept that we now need to do what we have to do. It's all about keeping ahead of the virus. It's about flattening that curve. It's about ensuring that our health services aren't overwhelmed. It's about keeping people well. It's about preventing people becoming critically ill, and it's about saving lives. So we're having that conversation on an ongoing basis with our teenagers, and they get it, they understand it, but it's a tough time to keep people occupied. And my heart goes out to any family where they have kids preparing for exams for the junior cert or leaving cert. Thankfully, we don't have that, and I'm very grateful that we don't have that additional pressure. But I know from talking to others that it is incredibly anxious now for those families and for the young people concerned.
You mentioned the need to flatten the curve and some of the measures that have to be taken to try and achieve that. You've got a piece today on page 5 of the Irish Mail on Sunday. The headline, which I accept you probably didn't write, is "We need tougher laws to save lives now, Taoiseach." And you pose the question in the middle of it, why the government has not yet introduced full measures to protect people who are still at work to give full effect to social distancing. Those people worry that they may be bringing the virus home. And it seems the tenor of your piece is that you're looking for an escalation of the measures that are currently there. Can you explain exactly how you approach this now?
Well, certainly. And I think we have a bit of a dilemma at this point, and we need to resolve it collectively. On the one hand, it is absolutely essential that we have a sense of composure and calm, because not alone can we get through this crisis, but we will get through it. But we also have to be very realistic in terms of the kinds of measures that need to be taken to keep us safe. So I am concerned, Gavin, that tens of thousands of workers and their families are doing everything by the book, observing social distancing, keeping their kids and themselves and their elderly parents or grandparents safe. And yet tens of thousands of these workers are returning to workplaces, factory floors, to construction sites, to other places where it's just not possible to practice social distancing.
So do you believe the government should then tell them to close their business and shut down entirely for the duration of this?
I think what we need to do, a couple of things. Firstly, it needs to be clear that you cannot put yourself in harm's way, and that the health and safety of families and workers needs to be absolutely paramount. That's the bottom line. I think we need to make it possible for people to adopt safe behaviours, and that includes business people who rightly are looking at an almost disastrous situation. So we need to have the right income supports. We need to have the right welfare supports to make it possible for people to do the things that are safe. And then we need leadership from the top in a calm, considered but decisive way. I don't believe that we should be allowing any worker, and by extension their family, to continue in harm's way, where we know, because people certainly are telling me in very large numbers, that they are going to work and they know that they are not safe.
So in short, so then, yes, the summary of what you're proposing is that you want all of those businesses effectively to close their doors, to tell the workers to stay at home, but you want the state to step in to guarantee their incomes for the duration of that period.
I want every workplace where it is not possible to have safe social distancing and where workers are in danger, where their health and their safety is in danger. Yes, I believe that those concerns and businesses need to close.
But not a full closure, that only the ones that are unable to observe those rules.
I think then you have to assess what that looks like and what the precise impact of that is. But I think as things stand, we're sending out mixed messages to people. On the one hand, we're saying take responsibility, act responsibly, which is absolutely spot on. But at the same time, we're ignoring perhaps the elephant in the room, which is that we know that people, when they then go to work, are in environments and circumstances where they cannot live up to those standards. And I am saying we need to stop that now, because we have seen in other countries, tragically, the cost of delay, the cost of not making the hard calls, but the right calls at the right time. And we have seen, Gavin, that delay has cost people's lives. I don't want us to learn that lesson here. I want us to do everything that we can collectively to be ahead of the curve. So in my piece today, and let me repeat it on your show, I am saying that the system, that government, that people in leadership, by that I mean all of us, now need to step to the next chapter of this, and we need to ensure that people are not endangered when they go to work, because that is happening day and daily. And the awful thing with this virus, the international experience reflects that the tally of damage done by delay only becomes apparent in some cases in the most desperate of circumstances. You hear the figures from our hospitals. By no means is the system as of yet overwhelmed, but nonetheless, 26 people in intensive care is pause for concern and worry for all of us. Mm. We do not have infinite capacity. The HSE and the health workers are doing a great job to build that capacity. We need to support them and press that forward. But do you know what? The bigger responsibility falls to society more generally to do the things that keep us safe. And going to workplaces where you are exposed and in danger is unsafe behaviour.
We know about the welfare proposals that your party has tabled inside the last 24 or 36 hours, this idea of income support or a certain amount of the income being guaranteed for the duration of that time. And we already know that Regina Doherty says that she's working on something and may have some packages to announce either today or tomorrow. How would all of this be paid for? Because the last time that the state did have to step in and ensure that a lot of people were supported in similar ways was 10 to 12 years ago. And it resulted in pretty aggressive austerity for some years after, as the state tried to get itself back on an even keel and to balance the books. Now, even if the recovery is hopefully much swifter this time around, it still does beg the question as to how the state is going to be able to foot the bill for the billions, if not tens of billions, of extra spending that it's going to face in the coming year.
That's right. And I think we, first of all, need to get our priorities straight. So priority number one is to protect human health and to save lives. That's firstly. Number two, we need to do the things that, if you like, put the economy into a slumber, put it to sleep for a period of time. And we need to do it in a way that we give ourselves the very best chance of restarting and igniting the economy again quickly once we come out the far end of this public health emergency. And I think you have perhaps a fairly unique moment of consensus across politics and across jurisdictions that in order to do that, you need very, very strong income support, and that income support needs to be channeled through businesses in question to keep that relationship between workers and their employers.
But where does the state get the money for all of that?
We need to put things on pause. Our proposal in terms of income support, we've priced it at about $5 billion. It is an enormous sum of money. I believe it's money very, very well spent. If you were to say to me now, that where could we now, today, put our hand on $5 billion right this minute, I would remind you that there's, $13 billion in an escrow account in terms of the Apple tax money. We could reach to that. There are other methods in which, of course, we can raise money. The money will have to be raised. And this crisis now has to be radically different in its handling than the one you referred to a decade ago. Because as you recall, Gavin, as we all recall, the people, workers bailed out the banks. And you're right, hugely damaging austerity and cutbacks, the scars of which people still bear, were inflicted. We cannot walk down that path again. The approach this time has to be for government, the state, every agency of the state now to rally to protect not big interests, not banks, not big vested interests, but to protect workers, to protect families, to protect communities.
Okay.
And the money that is spent on doing that, let me tell you, will pay massive dividends, not just socially, but also economically in the medium term.
In the meantime, of course, we are still in the command of a caretaker government, albeit one which is operating with a certain amount of political consensus. How long do you believe that that is tenable? And what do you make in that light of Leo Varadkar's comments this morning in the Sunday Independent that he is open to a national unity government as long as you and your party aren't involved?
Well, I was disappointed to see that because we are in the grip of a global pandemic and a national public health emergency. And I think it's perhaps very revealing that foremost in Leo Varadkar's mind is still the politics of exclusion. You can't have a unity government. You can't have a consensus if you insist on excluding people like me, who represent what, a quarter of the population, of the voting population, in the last election.
Well, disappointed as you may be, then how much tenable, or how long can it be tenable for the outgoing caretaker administration to remain in place then? Because there is the argument that by replacing them with a new cabinet, that there's a lot of tumult and there's a lot less transition, and that maybe, you know, continuity is exactly what we need at a time like this.
But look, clearly it's not tenable that people who don't have an elected mandate continue on in ministerial positions. I think that's obvious in and of itself. It's also obvious to say in the last election that the electorate voted for a change of government. That still remains the case. That still remains the fact. It is also true to say that we are now in circumstances that none of us could have envisaged 5 or 6 or 7 weeks ago when the campaign was underway. And we have to work together in the first instance to face this crisis collectively. And that means inclusively. That means all of us. And yes, we need a new government. I think that process needs to continue. I don't see an argument for putting that process on ice. You need a government that can deliver for the people. To my mind, that means a government of change. It means a government that can meet the crisis of the coronavirus head on, but that can also plan ahead to deal with the consequences of this crisis in a way that safeguards the interests of workers and families and communities. So that's work in progress. We continue to engage with and to talk to other parties. I am very keen and anxious that the Dáil needs to continue to meet. And of course, that has to be in a much reduced fashion because we have to observe health and safety standards no more than anyone else. But you can't have a crisis like this unfold and big political decisions being taken without parliamentary oversight and without involving the public and for the public to see their points of view, their concerns, their criticisms aired in the Dáil. I think that's absolutely essential as well.
Leader of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald, TD for Dublin Central, thank you very much for joining us this morning on the Record. Yeah. Very good to speak to you. Let's talk to the Minister for Justice and Equality, Charlie Flanagan, who joins us on the line now. Minister, good morning to you.
Morning, Gavin. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. We'll talk about your own different brief and some of the broader political questions around the handling of all of this. But just one question that did come in on Twitter just a few moments ago about concerns around direct provision and how exactly people in direct provision might be protected from COVID-19. Because if we have examples this morning of 14 people in a nursing home who have become infected all through potentially dealing with the same healthcare worker, it does beg the question as to how it could be contained when people in direct provision tend to live in much more cramped conditions.
Indeed, I very much agree, and that is a real challenge, one of the many challenges. Actually, before I answer, you'll allow me just a comment on what is a really strange and exceptional Mother's Day. acknowledge that this is one of the special family days of the year, and of course it's not going to be the same. So I'd like to compliment and pay tribute to many of the mothers on the front line, not only in my own justice area, the Gardaí prisons, etc., but particularly in the health service. I wish them well on this important Mother's Day. As far as direct provision is concerned, yes, this is a real challenge, and we do have a duty of care to everybody in that system. We have been preparing. The HSE have been working closely with officials from my department and the appropriate agency, understanding protocols, making sure that all of the care centre managers are very much involved. What we are doing, actually, to very good effect, is being in a position to actually move people who have been in pressurised emergency accommodation in recent times, about 1,300-1,400 people in emergency accommodation, which is less than satisfactory. We're now in a position to offer accommodation to them in direct provision centres in places like Tullamore, like Ballinamore, like Carhartt-Savine, like Rosslare. But yes, I do accept what your caller has said, that this is a challenge, particularly ensuring that if there is somebody in the system who tests positive, that we can ensure a level of isolation not only for them, which we are doing, but also for other persons with whom they have made contact. And that's why over the next few days we're looking at further alternatives, perhaps the availability of further hotel accommodation, having regard to the fact that the hotel sector is particularly, I suppose,
but there's a bit of capacity there that there wouldn't usually
hit
be
now, yeah, with the tourist sector. But yes, I'm very much aware of it, and that's why we're in constant contact. HSE working closely with centre managers, ensuring that we've notices in different languages, ensuring that all of those who are seeking international protection are very much involved and that they are being protected.
Okay. You were in Templemore on Friday when we had the attestation of 390 new Gardaí, a lot of them who were rushed forward, who were from intakes that weren't expected to be graduating into full Garda rank for a little while yet. Given the circumstances in which they've had to be fast-tracked through, some of them perhaps only in training for as little as 5 weeks, are you happy that they are up to the task?
I am. That was a very good move, actually, because it ensured that we have over 300 new Gardaí out and about assisting in communities. All of these, and you're right about the training, all of these actually will be teamed up with experienced officers in the Garda stations. And all of these who were attested and graduated last Friday will be in stations next week right throughout the country. But none of them will be left alone. All of them will be teamed up, and they have received an element of training, which of course will stand them to very good stead. Because the Gardaí and the Irish Garda Síochána in particular, Gavin, since its foundation almost 100 years ago, has been particularly engaged at community level. That's what differentiates the Garda Síochána from other police services throughout the world, that as well as being involved in the prevention and the investigation and the detection of crime, they are also available to the community. And in an emergency situation like we have now, these new Gardaí, along with the 14,700 Gardaí who now comprise the Garda service, are actively engaged, calling to people in isolated areas up and down the country, maybe doing jobs that they wouldn't normally do, like, would say, the taking of prescriptions, like calling to people to see how they're getting on, making sure that any of the day-to-day issues and concerns that people living in rural Ireland and also in urban areas have are dealt with. And that's why the Gardaí have also hired, you may have seen some of them on the television, in excess of 200 vans and smaller vehicles from car hire companies. And again, only this week, the Garda Commissioner has overseen the signing of a contract for more Garda vehicles. So the record investment that government is engaged in with an Garda Síochána is actually producing dividends and offering protection and reassurance to people now in these emergency days.
Is there a fair chance that some of those new Gardaí could be deployed to the task of closing down pubs? Because we know that the power is there now. We've heard some anecdotal reports, particularly around Munster, of some pubs remaining open and trading despite the agreement agreement that the government reached with the various vintners bodies. Could those powers be used from this evening if they're needed by those new Gardaí?
Yes. And that is an issue that has been predominant, particularly on social media over the weekend. People calling in and people posting news to the effect that pubs are still open. Not sure if that is the case, but I spoke to Senior Gardaí about that last evening. And I do know that there have been checks and that there will continue to be checks up and down the country to ensure that the agreement that has been reached between the vintners and the publicans on the one hand and the government on the other, that pubs must close. We need to observe the social distancing. We need to accept the advice and we need, you know, we need to follow the advice and guidance that's been given. One of the principal headline issues is that we keep a safe distance. And of course, I think it's very difficult for pubs to operate in that new environment. That's why the agreement was reached. And that's why the government and all parties came together in the Dáil during the week to give the Minister for Health, you know, extra and special powers if needed on a temporary basis to ensure that orders can be given, to ensure that directions can be given by the Gardaí. Of course, these new Gardaí have the power and authority to do that. And if pubs remain open, after an order is made to close them, will then, of course, fines and sanctions kick in.
On the topics of large gatherings, Chris has texted into 53106 to say he can't understand why large shopping centres, which are packed with people, are still open and why the government isn't instructing them to close like they did with the pubs.
This is an issue that was discussed with Dr. Tony Houlihan and his team. And remember, these meetings take place on a daily basis and they are being reviewed and new advice and guidelines being introduced on a daily basis. It's accepted, actually, that many of the larger supermarkets are in a position to offer advice and guidance or even police them themselves. And that's why we see, again, in our shops and supermarkets when people go to buy necessary goods and groceries, that there is specific marking now on the floors. So the bigger supermarkets, as you say, to my mind, are in a position to ensure that there isn't what might be described as a mass gathering. And also, I noticed in some of the larger shops yesterday in Port Leisha that people are operating customer control, in that people can come in such numbers. There's somebody on the door with sanitizer who is also acting as a crowd control point. So this is working well so far. Of course, if there is anecdotal evidence or otherwise that these advice and guidelines are not being taken, well, then, of course, it's open to the public health officials to advise government to take decisions. And that's what we're seeing on the part of government, decisions taken in times of emergency in order to protect the public, to protect communities and to protect lives.
How long is it tenable for you and your colleagues in this sort of caretaker holding administration to remain in government? Because obviously there are significant jobs to be done and nobody wants disruption and everyone would like as much continuity and focus of purpose as possible. But there still remains a situation that you and your colleagues who are now going to have to be spending a huge amount of money are doing so without any mandate from the current Dáil, and it does seem as if democracy has to take a bit of a back seat in the middle of all of this.
Well, I think we saw during the week what can be done by consensus politics. I acknowledge, and indeed I want to acknowledge what the Sinn Féin leader has said earlier. I agree with some of the suggestions that she has put forward. Indeed, the Taoiseach has ensured that opposition leaders are briefed on a very regular basis and they're consulted. And I believe that's very important that we will continue to do that, not only because of the emergency times in which we're living, but because we don't have a Dáil functioning in the way that we're used to. But we have a government, and the law and constitution is quite clear on that. I mean, this isn't a caretaker government or an acting government. This is a government with full powers.
But you will get to a point, even though you do have the full powers, at some point you'll have to pass a budget or maybe a supplementary budget, and that's something that you as an outgoing government can't do because you will need Dáil approval for it.
Yes, well, the full panoply of government at the moment is going into the emergency. This is a national crisis. We have a government that's focused almost exclusively on dealing with the problem. But yes, of course, we're open to talks on government formation. In fact, talks are proceeding, albeit on something of a tentative basis. But we are consulting, and we do acknowledge, of course, that a new government will have to be found. And you know, the speed with which the talks can take place with a view towards reaching agreement will be largely determined by the ability of all the parties to get together and agree a programme for government. I don't very much agree with the concept of a national government just for the sake of a national government. Any change of government, or indeed any government, must be working to a particular programme, must be working to a particular timetable of events, must be working to a particular budget. But yes, I do accept what you say. And in time, of course, we will move towards a government formation. But for these days and for these emergency times in which we're now enduring, the focus must be on the national emergency. And that's why we are seeing the type of leadership and decisive decision making on the part of Leo Varadkar.
Well, OK, at least for the time being anyway, Minister for Justice and Equality, Charlie Flanagan, thank you very much for joining us this morning on The Record. Let's talk more about the global picture and exactly how different countries are comparing. We're joined on the line by John Byrne Murdoch, who is a data journalist at the Financial Times. John, thanks for taking our call this lunchtime. Good to talk to you. You've been spending a lot of the last few days putting together different graphs projecting how different countries are doing in terms of cases contracted and also, sadly, of mortalities. What's the general big picture from what you've seen over the last few days?
That's right, yeah, and thanks for having me on. The general picture is fairly clear, which is that in pretty much all Western countries, the rate of infections and the rate of mortality over time is pretty consistent, and all Western countries are heading for a similar sort of situation as we're seeing today in Italy, unless anything changes drastically in those countries.
So is it the situation then that do you think that a lot of those European countries, which are proving to be the real ground zero of this, if you don't mind me using that phrase, that have they all used the same measures, or have any of them become any more successful because they've introduced different containment, or are they all broadly along the same track?
So thus far, they are all pretty much going along the same track. There have been slightly different outcomes in some of these countries. So the disease is pretty much spreading at the same rate everywhere. But the outcomes have been slightly different. So Italy, I think, as some of your listeners will know, has had especially high mortality rates, partly because of their Italy has such a large elderly population. Mm. Partly the outbreak in northern Italy was allowed to get so far so quickly, which meant that the Italian healthcare system has been overwhelmed to an extent not necessarily seen in other countries. But yeah, the general pattern holds, which is that the number of deaths in each country is increasing by around one third every day. And it really does feel and it does look in the data as though it's inevitable that countries like the UK, like perhaps Ireland and other parts of Europe are on the same course as Italy if drastic action isn't taken very, very quickly.
Yeah, given the gap that there is between the time at which public health measures are taken, like, for example, the introduction of a national lockdown or the closing of pubs or the closing of schools, and the fact that then the virus takes up to 2 weeks to manifest, it means that sometimes, you know, what we're looking at today is actually a snapshot of the transmission of the virus 2 weeks ago. Do you think that it's at all possible for really any European country to try and avoid the same arc as Italy? Because I'm looking at some of your graphs in front of me, and it seems that the countries that have been able to drag the curve downwards are those where, you know, they're not liberal Western European democracies where they have a certain amount of liberal citizen power, that they are slightly more authoritarian regimes where people are able to enforce a lockdown with much greater ease.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd push back on that characterization slightly, just in the sense that, sure, China is an authoritarian state and was able to really enforce things quite drastically. But if we're thinking about places like Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, and there, I think, you know, sure, there's an element of that sort of stricter enforcement, but you've also got cultures there where things like wearing masks is much more of a normal thing for people to do if they feel ill at any point, let alone during a coronavirus outbreak. Mm-hmm. And also, in some cases, these are simply smaller societies where it's easier to enforce things. But yeah, I would say, you know, I don't think we should be coming into this saying there's nothing that can be done and just holding hands up. There are clearly lessons that can be learned. I think if we look to South Korea as a particular case study there, Korea had a pretty bad outbreak early on. And in terms of the number of cases, it was up there on the same trajectories as the UK, as Italy, as the US, Spain. But the main thing that Korea did there was they did an enormous amount of testing. They've been doing tens of thousands of tests per day, way before any other country got close to that level. And what that obviously allowed them to do is get a much better handle early on where in Korea, where in different cities these sort of small outbreaks were occurring, and then to combine that with the contact tracing, so this trace and test regime that we're seeing enacted in a few countries, which allows them to just get a much better idea of who's got this disease and where are they, and then you can you know, heavily, strictly quarantine those people, those areas, without necessarily having to lock down the entire country. Now, obviously, things have got far enough now in a lot of European countries that lockdowns are going to have to be part of this, the method of dealing with this as well. But I think it really can't be overstated that the steps that a country goes through to actually get this under control is all about that trace and test step, which is, you know, how once you've locked down and you're no longer spreading the disease, you then isolate where it is, you lock down those places even more heavily, and you can actually start allowing other parts of the country to come out of those most strict lockdown measures.
Aside from the comparisons that you've been helping to draw up between different countries and the rates of infection that they've had and the rates of mortality that they've had, you've also been doing some work comparing the projected UK death toll based on the policy that the British government was pursuing until just a couple of days ago, and then the US death toll and the way it might work as well. Tell us about this study from Imperial College in London, which had a pretty dramatic input on the change of tack from the British government this week.
Yeah, I mean the Imperial report is interesting. So they were looking at the load on the healthcare systems in the UK and US, and the numbers of deaths we might expect in different scenarios. And the key thing that report showed was that the problem with going for what the British government was initially pursuing in terms of a sort of mitigation strategy is that yes, it may lead to less disruption to society and to the economy, and it may lead to a slightly better herd immunity, which I think is a term that a few of your listeners will now have become familiar with. But the short-term cost in terms of load on the healthcare system and numbers of deaths would be vast. So we'd be talking about several hundred thousand deaths in even under some of these mitigation strategies that the government was initially looking at in the short term, whereas a much stricter suppression strategy, so the types of lockdowns that we've been talking about, could get those total numbers of deaths down into the tens of thousands or even to less than 10,000. Now, of course, that still sounds like a very large number, but compared to the several hundred thousands that we'd be talking about under a more sort of softy approach that was initially being talked about, it's obviously the preferred option.
Sure. I suppose the fact that this Imperial College report only came out a few days, though, after there had been this discussion about herd immunity, that those are a couple of very vital days when it comes to lost time, because then with the few days that they might have waited to, you know, change tack, to talk about closing schools, to talk about changing closing pubs and restaurants, I mean, based on the work that you've done by comparing the graphs in other countries, those few days were vital, really, weren't they?
Absolutely. I think, you know, one thing that I've been really trying to get across with these charts is that the pace of infections and deaths really ramps up remarkably quickly. And, you know, you can go from a situation where you've got a couple of dozen people dying per day, which, you know, in itself is pretty alarming, to hundreds of daily deaths in a very, very short space of time. We're talking about exponential growth here. And so taking a couple of days to think about closing schools or closing pubs and restaurants, those couple of days right now may feel like it's the difference between, say, 10 deaths and 30 deaths. But in a few weeks, those couple of days might be the difference between 100 and 1,000 deaths.
So, like, the idea then that if you'd waited 3 days, and if you'd said that if the number of cases goes up by about a third every day, that even if you wait 3 days to do things, then by the time you've introduced those measures, there are somewhere between 2 and 2.5 times more people infected. And then when you're using that as your base point, then the hill for the health services to climb afterwards is that much more acute.
Exactly that. And to be honest, it is surprising to me how other Western countries are not acting sooner, because the simple inevitability of this, as I say, in terms of looking at what's going on in the places like Italy and Spain, it's impossible to ignore. And the action, or more to the point, the lack of action taken by a lot of Western countries suggests that the governments are thinking that, oh, we're not going to be like that. But all of the data that we have suggests that exactly the same dynamics are going to play out in their countries as has done in places like Italy.
So does that mean then that all of those countries really ought to pursue the most restrictive force of lockdown possible, this idea of prohibiting all but the most necessary travel and having everyone effectively staying at home for the foreseeable future, because anything less is only postponing this?
I think, yeah, it's hard to argue against that. And if you look, some countries are beginning to act earlier. Belgium has put into force its own restrictive lockdowns before they've actually had more than 10 deaths. Australia today is four Australian states are starting to consider lockdowns. Four US states have put lockdowns in place. And, you know, the thing is as well, we're not just talking about the human cost here. Obviously, the human cost and the public health argument is a huge part of this. But the economic impact will also be much worse the longer it takes a country to act. Again, if we look at some of the Asian countries who've been doing quite well in handling the crisis, so again, Korea, Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong, they have to a decent extent been able to get their societies moving again already, because they managed to clamp down on this before it got out of control. Whereas if you look at Italy and if you look at the UK and the US, Boris Johnson's been talking about 12 weeks of measures that may be needed. Now, if he's already talking about 12 weeks, the slower the UK is to act, and the same goes for other Western countries, that 12-week period of substantial economic downturn could be extended, whereas countries that act early are able to only have to put those measures in place for a short amount of time. So the point being, whether we're talking about human cost or economic cost, the longer it takes a country to act, the higher the cost is going to be.
John, stay with us just for one final question. Just before I let you go, I do want you to hear some audio from Dr. Michael Ryan, of course, a Sligo man whose voice we've all become very familiar with in the last few days. He's executive director of the World Health Organization. He was talking to Andrew Marr on the BBC earlier on. Here's what he said in terms of where the UK stands within the countries with the worst record in terms of numbers.
In terms of the top 10 countries in the world, four of the top 10 are currently, six of the top 10, are actually currently European countries. We've seen the number of cases jump in Europe over the last 2 weeks, and in particular, beginning to see spikes in deaths in places like Spain. Obviously, you've seen Italy, but we also have Germany, Switzerland, and France. And clearly, the epidemics in each country are not accelerating at the same rate, and they didn't start at the same time. But it would be important to remember that the UK may experience a more severe epidemic. But you've got a great NHS in the UK. You've got a fabulous health service. You've got a huge faith in that service. And I think it's really important that people trust the NHS, and that we all work together to ensure that the patients we most need get the best care as soon as possible.
Michael Ryan, the executive director of the WHO, who was speaking to Andrew Marr on the BBC earlier. John, I suppose he's just reinforcing the point that along with the numbers and the models, that the actual capacity of the health services in each country to respond to this is going to be a huge factor.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, that's why we're seeing things like in the UK, the acquisition of resources from the private healthcare sector into the public sector. And so, yeah, this is absolutely going to be a factor. But again, one of the points made in the Imperial College report, which we referenced earlier, is that even in some of the best case scenarios here, it's highly likely that the surge capacity, so that even the exceptional capacity in terms of intensive care unit beds in on the NHS could be exceeded. And, you know, under the most strict and early suppression and lockdown measures, we might be able to get the number of cases down closer to that capacity. But if that capacity is exceeded, that's where you start run into real problems. So again, just to quickly look back to Italy, one of the reasons Italy's death toll is, or Italy's mortality.
Oh, I think we've lost John. I think we got the general gist of the point that John was making, but I think one point that he was really is worth reinforcing just in terms of the significance of the numbers. When he talks about how the experience from pretty much every country is that the number of cases goes up by a third every day, that means that if you effectively do nothing, or if you only impose the most liberal of lockdown moves, that in the course of a week, the number of patients with coronavirus will increase sevenfold. That where you had 100 patients at the start of the week, you'll have 736 patients at the end of it. And when you talk about the impact that that's going to have on health services, it's going to be pretty remarkable stuff that we're going to see all across Europe in the next week or so.